You are listening to KBOO Portland. This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and by the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information is available at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org. This is KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for People Rise Up. Good morning. You are listening to People Rise Up on your community-owned radio station, KBOO. My name is Andrew Geller, and today I'm going to be talking about energy policy, and not all sorts of energy policy, but just a couple of aspects of what the Bush administration and the Congress are trying to put through. The Bush energy strategy has been stalled for several years, thankfully. Unfortunately, the House has passed H.R. 6 about a week and a half or so back, actually on Earth Day even, rewarding the fossil cartel with lots of tax breaks and trying to streamline the process to get the nuclear power industry going again. And that's what I'm going to be speaking about in the first part of today's show, which will run just a little longer than a half hour today, so you know. Michael Marriott, the executive director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, joins me to talk about nuclear power. Welcome to our airwaves, Michael.
Oh, thank you. Good morning.
And just to let people know, in the second half of the program, we'll be talking about alternative options regarding energy policy and planning that actually would achieve what some of the rhetoric Bush talks about, as opposed to the plan he's putting forward. But we're going to talk about the nuclear power aspect of the Bush plan, because it's in my opinion, the biggest divergence from sort of the standard practice of crafting energy policy. The Bush administration is heavily pushing for new nuclear power plants here, and we're going to talk about why that's a bad idea, because maybe a lot of people don't know about the history of nuclear power and its failings here in the U.S., because we haven't had a new nuclear plant ordered in over 30 years. Just to let people know, the Nuclear Information and Resource Service is a national information and networking center and is the U.S. part of, what does WISE stand for? Tell me what WISE stands for, Michael.
World Information Service on Energy.
That's the one. Okay, so you folks just recently put out a report regarding nuclear power and climate change, saying that it is no solution for the issue of climate change. Now, it's pretty straightforward that the actual fission process to heat water, to make steam, to drive turbines, to create electricity doesn't create any carbon in that process, But you folks say that nuclear power, this report says that nuclear power is actually a pretty significant carbon emitter. Can you explain how that is?
Well, sure. The basic issue, a lot of people, ourselves included, really, are looking for solutions to climate change. I mean, it's a real problem. We have to deal with it, and we have to deal with it quickly. We have to deal with it smartly. And if you don't look beneath the surface, nuclear power sounds attractive, because you're right that the basic reactors are not significant carbon emitters at all. But when you look at the technology in a little more detail, you find out that it's not the solution for several reasons. First of all, as you suggested, it's not carbon-free, because the reactor is only one stage of a very lengthy nuclear fuel chain, which begins with the mining of uranium, goes into processing of uranium, enrichment of uranium, the fabrication of the fuel. Then you finally get to the reactor stage, and then you have created tons of lethal radioactive waste that have to be secured into perpetuity. And in each of those other steps of the chain, there are carbon emissions associated with the power, you know, from the power needed to run some of these processes. Most people don't know that the uranium enrichment plant, there's only one in the United States right now, at Paducah, Kentucky. It is the nation's largest emitter of chlorofluorocarbons, which are both ozone destroyers and global warming gases. And most people think that those were banned by the Montreal Protocol quite a few years ago, which was the case except for the Paducah plant, which was grandfathered. So, you know, we're still spewing those into the atmosphere, and they're coming from that plant. But so when you look at the entire picture, nuclear power is actually a lot closer to natural gas than it is to more sustainable energy sources like wind and solar. But then the second thing you have to look at is, how can we, as a society, most speedily and most effectively and most economically, because we have limited resources, address climate change? And there is where nuclear fails to test even more greatly, because in order to, and this has been shown by studies at MIT, by the National Commission on Energy Policy, by the International Atomic Energy Agency, but these aren't our studies, these are their studies, in order to make any kind of significant dent in climate change, using nuclear power, what you'd have to do is, first of all, close a whole lot of existing coal plants, which the utilities don't plan to do. And second, you would have to replace them with new nuclear plants on the order of 300 to 400 in the United States alone. We currently have 103, so we're talking about tripling to quadrupling how many we have in this country, and some 1,500 worldwide, which, again, is almost a quadrupling of the worldwide capacity. And that's just not feasible. It's not feasible in any kind of meaningful time frame. To do that over the next 50 years would mean, starting today, putting up a new reactor every 6 months. Well, you know, these things take 10 years to build, just one of them. It would cost trillions of dollars. It would require the establishment of a Yucca Mountain, Nevada-sized radioactive waste dump somewhere in the world every 3 to 4 years. We haven't been able to build Yucca Mountain in 25 years in this country, nor has any other country been able to build a permanent waste dump.
Well, and one of the
and you go on and on. It would produce, you know, thousands of pounds of new plutonium. It would set up nuclear proliferation risks. It would add 1,500 new terrorist targets across the world. It's just a program that makes no sense whatsoever.
And April 27th, George W. Bush was speaking at the National Small Business Conference in Washington, D.C., and he said, quote, "One of the greatest obstacles we face to building new plants is regulatory uncertainty, which discourages new plant construction. We must provide greater certainty to those who risk capital if we want to expand a safe, clean source of energy that will make us less dependent on foreign sources of energy." And he's specifically referencing nuclear power plants there. It really wasn't so much regulatory uncertainty, as far as I'm aware, that's shot down every plant in the last 30 years, and possibly more before that, is the fact that people didn't want nuclear power plants because, A, they're really expensive, they're potentially really dangerous in a whole bunch of different ways, and as you mentioned, the lag time in construction is such that, you know, say you wanted to do, decided to build a whole bunch of plants, again, it's not going to have any sort of impact whatsoever for a good 8-10 years. And the House Energy Bill, H.R. 6, that I referenced earlier, has provisions in it to streamline the licensing process. And that's one of the big thrusts of the Bush Energy Plan, is to streamline nuclear facility siting. And it remains to be seen what could come up in the Senate. Do you feel as though George W. Bush's statement about regulatory uncertainty was discouraging new plant construction? Is that accurate?
It's actually kind of, 15 years ago, the nuclear industry prevailed upon the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to change its licensing regulations. All of the plants that exist out there now went through what's called a two-step process, where there were separate hearings at the construction stage, and then hearings with opportunities for the public to participate when the reactor was nearly completed, and they would ask for an operating license. Well, the industry won, and the NRC put in this new licensing process. It's informally known as a one-step process. We took them to court, NERS did. We won at the federal appeals court level. The government appealed, and Congress made the whole matter moot by going ahead and adopting the industry's proposal. So they already have this streamlined licensing process, and it's been on the books since 1992. It's ironic that the industry and George Bush don't think that the industry's own self-designed licensing process isn't good enough for them now. And what they're really looking for now is not streamlining as much as what they call risk insurance. Right. They want to actually be paid if there's any delays in the licensing process, which is sort of the height of gall in my belief. You know, what really knocked out the nuclear industry in the 1970s and 80s was a confluence of three issues, and they are the same three issues that have plagued the industry all along and continue to plague it today, and that's economics, radioactive waste, and safety. The plants became too expensive to build, too expensive to operate, too expensive to try to operate safely. We had accidents at Three Mile Island and in Chernobyl, and some lesser accidents that proved that, yes, nuclear accidents can, in fact, happen. And now we have the new issue of security and terrorism, which is a whole new issue that sort of just adds on to it. So all the issues that have always been there are still there, helping you know, providing some sort of risk insurance for licensing delays is a pretty meager tactic, and it's really just another way to transfer taxpayer dollars, I mean, your dollars, into the nuclear industry.
And the National Academy of Sciences recently declassified a study, or released a declassified study, that says, in fact, those highly radioactive storage pools at the 100-plus nuclear plants around the country, in fact, are seriously vulnerable to attack. And, you know, there's all this concern about the idea of so-called dirty bombs. Well, it seems like if one of those plants were hit in the right way, you got automatic dirty bomb with the spread of radioactivity.
Well, it's actually worse than that. The study you talked about is true, and the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission itself, tried to squelch the study. They tried to sit on it for months. They refused to allow it to be released, and finally the National Academy of Sciences released its own version. It's edited so that some of the more controversial parts we still haven't even seen yet. I mean, it's worse than it's been made public. But if you want to talk about dirty bombs, let's look no further than the proposed radioactive waste sites at Yucca Mountain, Nevada, and another one, a private one, in Utah on the land of the Skull Valley Goshute Tribe, which is about to receive approval from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. When we have those sites, we're talking about tens of thousands of transports of high-level waste across the country, from the Trojan plant up there on I-5 down to one of these sites, and all across the country, and tens of thousands of shipments, and each one is carrying 200 times the long-lived radioactive equivalent of a Hiroshima bomb. We have videotape of these casks with holes being put into them by a shoulder-fired rocket. I mean, these are potential dirty bombs, thousands of them. We call it mobile Chernobyl if this scenario takes place and we start moving this waste before we're ready.
We're closing in on the time we've got for the segment here about nuclear power, so we're not going to get to some of the remaining reasons in the NIRS report, Nuclear Power, No Solution to Climate Change, which addresses issues above and beyond greenhouse gases as to why a new nuclear power industry or revitalizing the nuclear power industry would be a really bad idea. But there's a link to the report at www.nirs.org and also at the People Rise Up website, this and much other information. So the House bill is going to be introduced in the Senate sort of soon. It's going to be different, and they're going to have to go to conference committee if the Senate can pass something. So given that, what would you encourage listeners to do in terms of trying to do what they can to guarantee that the Bush energy plan does not make its way through Congress?
Well, you really do have to let your senators know how you feel, and it's important for Oregon listeners to know that Ron Wyden is on the Energy Committee, the Senate Energy Committee, and is really can be a key player on this issue. During the last Congress, he and very conservative Senator John Sununu of New Hampshire made a very valiant effort to keep nuclear funding, to keep all the nuclear funding out of the bill. They lost by one vote, and it was a very important thing. It was the closest vote we've ever had in the U.S. Senate, and we're hoping that he may do this again this year, and that maybe we can win by one vote, but of course he has to have the public support needed to do that. But it's, you know, it's going to be a battle. There's no question about that, as I'm sure all of the listeners are aware. It's a Republican Congress, both Senate and House, and while the nuclear issue has been bipartisan, the odds of the energy bill passing this year have probably increased a little bit from last year. So it's really going to take more public involvement and more public outreach if we're going to stop this thing. And if we're going to have an energy policy in this country that works, that is sustainable and moves us in the right direction, we're first going to have to stop this bill. We can't, you know, this bill is so bad, gives so much money to the nuclear industry and the coal industry and the oil industry, that it's not the kind of bill that can be amended or fixed. I mean, first we're going to have to stop this, and then move on to create some legislation that actually would move us toward the 21st century in energy policy.
Michael Marriott is the executive director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. You can find out more about them online at www.nirs.org. It's a very well put together, comprehensive site with lots of links to other information. And thank you very much for joining us this morning to talk a little bit about the nuclear aspect of the Bush energy plan.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
And we'll be back in just a little bit here with Dan Carroll, co-founder of the Apollo Alliance, to talk about how to really achieve some of the rhetoric that the Bush energy plan references regarding growing the economy, protecting the environment, achieving greater energy independence, and creating jobs. We'll be back with him in a moment.